So today's July 2nd, 2014, and I'm Rick Hansen. And I don't know about you, but I felt unusually sort of zapped by that meditation. So that's probably a good thing, although who knows what might happen here. So that said, if you've been here the last couple times, and I do recommend, if you haven't been, listening to one or both of the talks from the last 2 weeks, which were really about the kind of bullseye of Buddha Dharma, for better or worse, this observation of the impermanent, fleeting, transient, insubstantial nature of our experiences, leading to a radical breakthrough around clinging, and less clinging as a result, which, by the way, isn't always a breakthrough. It's often a very progressive process. Okay, and that also opens up a consideration of what doesn't change, the underlying nature of things, and perhaps something that's really difficult to talk about, yet many people have a very deep and meaningful intuition of something transcendental, something unconditioned, something that's not, as the Buddha put it, subject to arising and passing away. Something that is, as he put it, also deathless, the unconditioned. That's pretty heavy stuff. And it's easy to spin up and out into intellectualisms about it. There's, I think, a little place for clarity of thought, pointing out instructions. But where the action really is, it's coming really down into the intimacy with our own experience. And it's passing nature. Okay. To do that, to really stay present with experience as it changes, you know, staying present in this moment as it passes away, now after now after now, and also to be able to tolerate the sort of unsettling, even alarming nature of that process, we need to be able to find refuge in those things that, in this life at least, reliably feed us. So I want to talk about taking refuge tonight and finding refuge as a fundamental aspect of practice, and share with you some very meaningful, personally meaningful things that I do around refuge. So just the word alone, what's it bring to mind, refuge? I mean, for me, I think about these places in Hawaii, these sacred territories where if you were being chased by another tribe, that if they caught you, they would kill you right on the spot. If you cross that line and you're now on this sacred ground, you're safe. You have found your refuge. Or think about that place you had when you were a child, little kid, you know, grandma's kitchen, that special tree, with your friend, with your dog, you know, reading a book quietly. Finally, they're leaving you alone. Whatever that refuge was, being in nature, doing art, right? What did it feel like to be in that refuge? It does something to us, or for us, doesn't it? These days, who are those people whose gaze is a refuge for you? Right? In their gaze, you feel safe, you feel seen, you feel cared for, you feel at peace. You can relax and come home. Right? That's refuge. As you probably know, in Buddhism, one of the defining characteristics, if you will, of Buddhist practice is in terms of refuge. So basically, classically, there are two criteria, and you can have either or both, as defining someone who is Buddhist to the extent that that's meaningful. And I say this not as an enrollment strategy or as a membership criteria, but just to point out the centrality of these things. So one, as I've talked about in the last couple weeks, one defining characteristic, if you will, of Buddhist practice is a recognition that all which is subject to arising is also subject to passing away. That's a defining characteristic of Buddhist practice. Like if someone who does that, someone who's engaged in that, is Buddhist, as it were. A second defining characteristic is taking refuge in three things: the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. Buddha can be taken in different ways. can be a kind of confidence in, a reason-based credibility around the Buddhist teachings. Like, oh yeah, he seems to be right at least most of the time, so I'll think about the next thing he says, for example. Refuge in the Buddha can also be taken to mean refuge in the capacity for awakening in everyone's heart, distinct from the historical individual who lived roughly 2,500 years ago. A second, so then Dharma. Dharma means two things, basically. It means reality, what's true, what is, what's the case, the suchness of things. And Dharma also means an accurate model of, or representation of, or account of what's true, which has a narrow meaning, a relatively narrow meaning of Buddha Dharma, you know, the collection of teachings, perspectives in the Buddha stream. So we take refuge in teaching, and in a particular collection of teachings, and in a broader sense, we take refuge in reality itself. I mean, for me, somewhere I think in my 20s, the phrase just arose in terms of kind of a guiding light for me, a North Star of, you know, bowing at the altar of reality. What is true? You know, being grounded in what's true with this person, with this job, with this addictive desire, with this burst of anger, what's true? And then the third refuge is Sangha, which originally meant a gathering of monks or monastics on the path, coming together. Congregation, in some meaning of that word, which has both a vertical and a horizontal dimension. So it's taking refuge in teachers and teachers' teachers. So I think about encounters I've had with people who've been teachers for me, people whose practice I have a lot of respect for, both personal encounters and reading the stream. Like, for example, in only the most distant sense, I've ever met Thich Nhat Hanh, you know, in a small gathering of only 3,000 people. But I've read his writings, and I have a real sense of respect for him as a teacher. So we take refuge in our teachers, right? And our teachers' teachers, all the way back, as far as you care to take it, or a wisdom stream altogether. That's sort of the vertical dimension. And the more horizontal dimension of Sangha is community, gathering together with spiritual friends. And you could extend that notion of Sangha out to family, friends, even nature and the natural world altogether. You know, finding Sangha in this extraordinary universe as it is. So these are three classic refuges. It's really okay not to take refuge in them. It's also okay to find other refuges. Also, there's a key point here about how we relate to what is refuge. So whether, just using the example of Dharma as a refuge, teaching or truth as a refuge, we could think of it as, often it's talked about, the traditional formulation is, I go to refuge in the Buddha, I go to refuge, or I go for refuge in the Buddha, I go to refuge or for refuge in the Dharma or the Sangha. So it's out there. It's dualistic. We're going to it. Okay, there's a place for that. I'm going to the temple, right? I'm going to sit on this quiet chair in my backyard. Please leave me alone for the next 10 minutes. Parents will go seek refuge in the bathroom and lock the door. Of course, the preschoolers are pounding on the door. But anyway, I'm going to that refuge. Okay, there's a place for that. All right. But another way to think about refuge is that it's already present in here. So I'm giving over to that refuge which is already true in here. Or I'm feeling my way into what's already true inside about that refuge. See that different way to relate to it? And I find that second way to relate to refuge extremely powerful because it undermines the search. It undermines, you know, dualisms of various kinds. And it immediately is rewarding, like, oh, here I am in this refuge, whatever that might be for you. So at this point, I invite you to reflect on what are those things which are refuge for you in the sense of offering protection or refueling or something that's sacred in the way that word means something to you. Or simply a place that is a kind of respite, a place where you go, whew. Don't we all need that whew moment? All right. So now I'll be quite personal and talk about a practice I began doing that some years ago, just kind of casually, that became extremely valuable for me and useful. I started taking refuge in 7 things every day, and they became 8. And I made a commitment personally to never let a day go by in which I did not, in some meaningful way, take refuge in these 7 and then 8 things. I would often weave it into my meditation. Sometimes I'd be lying there in bed, waking up, and I would just kind of float through the 7 things. Sometimes I'd realize, holy moly, at 11 o'clock at night, no refuges yet. Okay, got to do it. So yes, it was fairly brisk, but 7 authentic moments. So I invite you to feel, your way in yourself into whatever works for you. It's okay to be flexible about this. So for me personally, my first of the 8 refuges is the divine, something transcendental. That's personally meaningful to me. So I might say to myself in my own mind, I take refuge in God, or I take refuge in the divine, or it might be something wordless. And taking refuge for me especially is kind of like, what's the felt sense of the divine here and now, right? And can there be a presencing of this experience here and now? So it's felt, it's experiential, it's accessible. And then, some moments will pass. Sometimes my mind will wander. Sometimes I'll just move right through the 7 things. Then the next thing is, I take refuge in awareness, ordinary human awareness, nothing cosmic, awareness, awareness. And then kind of go to what it feels like to just, all right, I'm rested in awareness. There's an observing, or there's simply a kind of being the space in which stuff comes and goes, arises and passes away. Awareness. Or wow, what a relief that we can be aware of our sadness, our pain, our desires, our fears, our anger, right, without being identified with them, right? We're watching the movie 20 rows back. Whoa, weird. Instead of being glued to the screen. Awareness. 3rd refuge for me is impermanence, or the way I put it is emptiness. And it's the weirdest thing to take refuge in. Emptiness in the technical sense of the lack of a fixed self, a lack of a fixed I. And more broadly, the way in which nothing has absolute self-existence, so possibility can occur. Something about this, And I was surprised, actually, when I started taking refuge in emptiness. I thought it would be just sort of philosophical, but there's a kind of a bzz, bzz that happens when I take refuge in emptiness. Like something is zapping my conventional way of being a mind, right? Minding my own business. Right? Moment by moment. So that, do you know what I mean by emptiness in the technical sense? It's the nature of things to be interdependently arising, everything's connected to everything else, and any particular thing, certainly any particular experience, and most, if not all, of materiality has this quality to it, this nature of emptiness. Okay? Then I've added the eighth one when as I've gotten more and more interested in unconditionality, is the word I use. I don't use the word unconditioned so much because it sounds like a static thing, a noun, when by the definition, unconditionality, the deathless, is not a noun. But for me, I asked my friend once, Tom, just kind of on the fly, Tom, what do you think God is? Tom said, without missing a beat, possibility. Wow. Take that in a deep way, not a Tony Robbins kind of way. A deep, nothing wrong with Tony Robbins from my perspective, that said, a deep way. Like, wow, the possibility. Unconditionality enables possibility. It enables the possibility of the next instant of that which is conditioned. Okay. And again, you find what works for you. Like for me, there's a felt sense of unconditionality. When I go unconditionality, something else happens there, you know, around an increasing transparency or accessibility for unconditionality to work through, right? Another way of saying refuges is not I go to or I go for or I take refuge in, but abiding as the divine, abiding as awareness, abiding as emptiness, abiding as love, abiding as unconditionality. See what I mean? It's a claiming, it's an owning from the inside out, here and now, of whatever it is for you. I'm just sharing what's been very meaningful to me. Then, woven really through all this is, as I said, love. Fundamental warm-heartedness. I find that a warm-heartedness naturally arises as I abide as these four things I've named so far or take refuge in them. You may want to call out love very explicitly as something to take refuge in or feeling cared about, feeling connected. And then in the other four, I take refuge in the Buddha, both as a teacher and the Buddha within, if you will, the awakened mind that's already here, just kind of covered over with a certain amount of sludge. I had a teacher who described the layers of sludge as whipped cream, mud, and cement. You know? But then there's that which is under it. Then Dharma, just taking refuge in, yeah, I know basically the basic Buddha Dharma is true as far as I can tell. Stuff changes. If I get my knickers in a twist, it's a bummer for me and others. Don't be evil. Variations on that. I trust that. I trust that body of teaching. I'm trying to, you know, give over to it. Let it carry me along. Another way to think of refuge is what are those streams that you want to give yourself over to? That will carry you along in this life, right? We're all carried by one stream or another. Which river, you know, do we want to jump into? Okay. And then Sangha, I think about my teachers, I think about community, I think about the worldwide Sangha in some ways, often, of good-hearted people, trying their best, working it out. And then I take refuge in practice. This idea that if we just kind of keep practicing, noodling around, departing from the path, getting back on the path, departing from the path, getting back on the path, copping to our stuff, trying to get faster and faster, taking responsibility for our crud, our neurotic craziness, you know, practice, taking refuge in practice, something sincere about that. As messed up as one is, we can always take refuge in practice. From this point forward. So, those are eight for me. I'm less formal in my taking of them every day now. A nice way to start a meditation or be a part of a meditation is some meaningful felt sense of whatever is refuge for you. You know, however you conceive of it. What's your shield? What's your anchor? What's your wellspring? What feeds you from the inside out? What's that good stream you want to align yourself with and abide as. So that's the invitation, you know, is to take refuge, is to find refuge, is to abide as refuge, is to be this refuge, even as it grows inside you. So I wonder what you think about this, how you feel about refuge and what could be refuges for you personally. And how might you formalize in a way that's meaningful your resting as refuge, whatever those wholesome factors are. You know, resting as them, anchoring yourself in them more and more deeply. So, you know, they shine through your face more and more. What are your refuges? What are your own practices of refuge? Or what might feel valuable to you to undertake more of?
For me.
Great, please.
For me, it's remembering all the things that I'm grateful for and listing them, and things that I take for granted. And that's refuge for me.
Yeah. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Great.
For about 2 years, and then continuing on, but really earnestly for 2 years, I took refuge in willingness. Saying, I am willing to whatever it is. So if it was something that was painful, I would go, I am willing. If it was something that was beautiful, I would go, I would be thankful. And then that transition to add impermanence, imperfection, and unpredictability. And those have been really transformative. I hadn't heard the language take refuge in, and I'm going to be adding some things to that list.
Thank you. Please.
I take refuge in journaling.
Ah, yeah.
And I'll read the previous day, and on the day that I'm doing, I'll read again, and also correct it so I can actually read it the next day. And I think it, for me, it's an exercise in remembering where I am and where I'm going, and in awareness.
Thank you. Yeah. Please.
It's kind of physical, a physical space, but beyond. So I have a little alcove in my house where I have a very precious thing, which is my stereo. And I also have some shelves with pictures of all my, I call them my dead people. I know that's gruesome, but they're my family and my friends who've passed. And they're my people. In their bodies. And so every few days or as needed, I go in my garden and I cut flowers, if there are flowers available. And then I make just flowers for the, and I kind of move pictures around. And lately I've been taking care of the girls, like my mom and my aunt and my grandmother's. My great grandmother, you know, I'm like, okay, the girls get roses. And then I keep adding the guys, like, oh, my brother gets in on this, and my uncle, and my, oh, Brady, and my dad. And so, you know, it's almost like playing house. It's kind of interesting. It's been sort of expanding a little lately because I have more flowers. So that's what I've been doing.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Yeah, please.
Rick, I wonder if you could talk about the difference between refuge and running away.
Well, could you say a little bit about, you know, what you mean by maybe running away?
Yeah, you don't want to deal with something.
Yeah.
And it's too painful, or it's too much of a conundrum, or you find yourself getting angry. I mean, there's obvious running away, there's drinking, there's drugs, there's those kinds of things, but I don't know, is there a point at which it's not refuge, it's negating, it's abdicating your responsibility to deal with something?
Yeah, that's what, if I get you right, I think that's what you're talking about. You're, Yeah, escape, or what's the edge where we're avoiding dealing with something that we need to deal with, rather than doing a timeout so that we can kind of get our heads straight to actually then really deal with it. And I think there's probably plenty of wisdom about that. You know, I'll say that for me, I think about the idea that in relationships, when things get heated, it's important for both partners to respect a timeout signal. But it's also important, in my own view, and I've written about this, that whoever it is who declares timeout is willing to say when concretely, or being willing to say soon when concretely, and within a near term, like 48 hours or if not sooner, when concretely we can re-engage around this. So it's not just stonewalling. You know, it's a pause, not stonewalling. So I think about the place for that. And I guess a little part of me thinks about that balance point in people's personal practice. Are they, which side are we erring on? Are we avoiding the tough stuff that we need to engage in our practice and, you know, work through, release, develop insight into, grow alternatives to, right? On the other hand, I think a lot of times we're just banging away at stuff dutifully. You know, we're so determined, we just want to bang and bang and bang, and it's like, ugh. What we really need to do is take a break from it for a while and really refuel ourselves so that we can come back to it with a whole heart. So maybe, I think a question is, I suspect, you know, for just about every person in this room, you know in your heart which way you tend to lean. Do you tend to chew away at stuff to a fault? Or do you tend to, look away, move away to a fault? And then that kind of tells you what your correction ought to be, I think. You know, that's a really cool thing. I'm going to reflect more about what you're bringing up. I suspect other people will as well.
Yeah, a reflection about that question. It's a very interesting question.
Yeah.
And I take the practice of going into impermanence. So in going into impermanence, I actually dive into the feelings around that. And so dive into the feelings of the losses of love and dive into the feelings of my back pain is impermanent. And that there's some refuge in knowing that impermanence has a truth to it. I can count on impermanence. And that, I have refuge in the fact that I can count on it. Where in the past, I would rail against it. I would think that things were going to be permanent when in fact they really weren't. And so I take refuge by actually diving into the painful parts of impermanence and realizing
cool. Yeah, good. Thank you. Yeah. Refuges. Yeah, please.
What I've been doing lately is practicing being very present.
Can you talk louder, please?
What I've been doing is practicing being very present in the now, right here, right now, without thinking.
Thank you. Yeah. Does anybody take refuge in cooking or knitting, making music, making art? I know Tarane takes a lot of refuge in art making. Or who takes refuge in rocking the baby Or petting the cat. Yeah. Or who takes refuge in the shower? Or the first cup of coffee in the morning? Right? Or in... Right? Okay, you can admit it. Who takes refuge in Jon Stewart? Anyway. Right? Okay, are there other... I saw some hands over here, right? Great. Yeah, please.
To something more truthful.
Right.
And it can also be just coming to reality. This is the ultimate truth right here. So it's more of a way of presence.
Thank you very much. Yeah. Anything about the experience of giving yourself over to refuge, broadly defined, giving yourself over to that which feeds you and protects you and aligns you? You know, with awakening. You know, what's that like? Yeah.
I have a experience of refuge with where I am. I would call it in my sort of real feelings or authentic feelings.
Yeah.
Where it kind of goes through all the layers of dialogue and story down to some more core place. And when I'm connected there, it feels safe.
Yeah, I get it, really. Think about the embodied experiences of giving yourself over to something good carrying you along. Like I'm thinking of rivers that I've done where you basically have a life jacket on and you kind of sit and you give yourself over to the river that carries you in a nice way, right? Or you might have a feeling of, you know, like wind or air or some kind of stream or, you know, admitting or giving up to some wholesome influence. Right? That's a lot what this is about, giving ourselves over to some wholesome influence or factor. You know, making an autonomous decision in some sense to give up some autonomy, to give ourselves over to something that's good to carry us further. You have a feeling for that? I find that really nice, you know. Do you know the story of Krishna and the gopis? This is a Hindu story. I'm seeing some nods. So the gopis were cowherds. They herded the cattle. And in this story, cattle are a metaphor for base worldly concerns. You know, in my case, the 150 emails, literally, I've received in the last 2 days. I experienced email dukkha. Mostly from the people who work for me. So, you know, what am I doing? But anyway. Okay. So, anyway. And you can imagine what, so here's the story. Supposedly Krishna, manifestation of the divine. You can think of Krishna however you like. You know, a teacher, what have you. Krishna rolls in, and Krishna basically just starts playing his flute. And he's this very appealing character, embodying delight and joy and wisdom and awakening and beauty and whoa, okay? And so what the gopis do, these cowherds, they are just drawn to the music and to the feeling, the intuition they have of, wow, this is beautiful. This is really carrying me along. And so then they left their cattle and went to join Krishna. They took refuge in Krishna, basically. And a key point about the story is that he didn't have to give them any lectures about how base their worldly concerns were and the hindrances and the defilements and commandments not to do bad stuff, what have you. He just played his flute. He just played his music. He just kind of was who he was. And he attracted them. It's the principle of attraction. So you think about raising kids, for example, or teenagers. You know, yes, we can, and there's a place for preventing them from doing what's bad, as it were, loosely defined. But what about the element of attraction to what's good, right? In our own life, what's the element of attraction to the wholesome, to what's good? Also, Krishna didn't have to make some kind of long, elaborate pitch about why it would be cool to hang out with him, right? He, this representative window manifestation of something beautiful and extraordinary, just kind of hung out, and people were naturally drawn to it, and they joined with him. In the story, literally, in some fundamental sense, making love with the divine. Are we making love with our refuges in some sense of intimacy with them and receiving of them and being willing to be fed by them? Yeah. And what would that be like for you, including in a sacred way? Yeah, Linda.
So exploring refuges that I would go to,
mm-hmm.
and you're talking about abiding as,
mm-hmm.
abiding as presence, or abiding as awareness, or abiding as love, then that means at some point we become refuge for other people.
Yeah.
And I think that's true in many of the roles that we play, but we don't always see ourselves perhaps as where other people could come and find refuge. And I think that moves it up to another level.
Yeah, I think that's really beautiful. And respecting how we are refuge for people and facing the ways that could feel like too much of a responsibility or a little awkward, you know, or something, we may push someone away, and yet there's a place for them to find refuge in us. Yeah. All right. So, see what you want to do. You might want to play around with more formally finding refuge, taking refuge, abiding as refuge. Maybe you're dealing with some challenges these days, and it would serve you, honestly, to have more pit stops, you know? Whatever that is, a physical pit stop or a more of a mental pit stop, or grow resources inside that you can draw upon, inner strengths of various kinds that you can draw upon to deal with challenges, perhaps. Maybe those are some of your refuges. And as we are increasingly buoyed by these wholesome refuges, then we have a growing capacity to be at peace with the passing show of experiences. And we can hold our life much more lightly. Let's sit for a minute and take refuge in things ending. I love my bell. I've had my bell since I was about 23 years old. I love my bell. Okay, see you. See you next week. Exactly. Exactly.